Who are the candidates running for governor? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
To restore power back to the level where people live instead of Tallahassee, where the politicians live.
It's that time again when political ads remind us that it's election season, and there are plenty of names for voters to choose from in this year's gubernatorial primary races. We're planning to have conversations with all those candidates. Today, we talk to former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine.
Stop the shooting! We don't want to die! Stop the shooting!
Shortly after the Parkland shooting, there was a meeting at a church in Liberty City. People were talking about gun violence, and they want lawmakers to remember that dozens of children die every year from guns, and it's usually not in mass shootings. Finally, we'll look at the Florida Supreme Court making history once again. They're now going to Facebook Live. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, there's already a wide field of candidates running for governor of Florida in November, and there's still time for more people to jump into the race. The primaries won't be held until late August. We're going to start talking to the candidates one-on-one so you can get to know them better. The declared Republican candidates include U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis and Florida Commissioner of Agriculture Adam Putnam. The Democratic side includes Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham, businessman Chris King, and our next guest, former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine. Mayor Levine, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And I just want to mention, by the way, if you have a question for our gubernatorial candidate, Mayor Levine, please give us a call, 800-743-9576, or you can tweet us. Find us at WLRN Sundial. Okay, what made you want to run for governor? Why do you want to be governor of Florida?
Well, I love being mayor of Miami Beach two terms. Everyone said, you got to run for a third term. You won't even have an opponent. And I said, listen, every single thing we said we're going to do in Miami Beach, we've done it. And if it's not done, it's in process. And I believe in the American dream. And I believe in the Florida dream. And I thought that I could help the state of Florida. And I believe it. I believe our state is crucial. We're at a turning point right now. And I want to see our state turn into a 21st century economy where everyone has the opportunity to live the American dream. And I think I can do it.
Well, you know what? For the last couple decades plus, Republicans have held on to the governor's office and the legislature. So what makes you think that now voters are ready for a Democrat?
Well, I can tell you this. I think I have a unique message, Lewis. I'm a successful entrepreneur who started with $500 and built some incredible companies in South Florida and then became a successful two-term mayor. So I think my message is different, being pro-people, pro-business. As I said, not right, I'm not left, I'm forward. I am a Democrat, proud to be a Democrat. Before I'm a Democrat, I'm an American. The one thing that's crucial, Luis, is that we're running a 67-county strategy all over the state of Florida. I'm everywhere all the time. The last four Democratic nominees for governor, who, by the way, were fantastic qualified people, you know where they came from? They actually came from northern Florida, central Florida. They came from Tampa. I believe the way to win as a Democrat is to come from an area where actually the majority of the population is. It's called South Florida, and that's why we're going to win. That was a great message.
Tell me about the three biggest priorities for you if you are governor.
Well, number one, it's an economic priority. I believe that what we need to do is we need to act more like the most admired companies in America. And people say, well, how can a Democrat be pro-business, pro-people? I said, well, let me tell you why. I said, right now, our governor has a state that's full of Applebee's, McDonald's, and Walmart's, everyone earning $8.25 an hour. I believe that I want to create a state that's full of GEs and Lockheed's and Apple's and Amazon's and great companies. So what I'm going to do is create a culture of excellence that attracts these companies to Florida. And how do you do it? You do it by modeling yourself after their HR manuals. They're all very similar. They're pro-environment. They're pro-education. They're pro-healthcare. They're anti-discrimination. And if you act like them, they too shall come. Because that to me, as President Kennedy said, a rising tide lifts all ships. That's what people want, opportunity.
All right, so that is, I've heard you say a couple times now, pro-business. Obviously, the governor has run on being a pro-business, pro-jobs platform for the last 8 years. But here's the thing, too, a little pushback is this is Florida. It's a tourist state. And it's not to say that we don't have other industries, but a lot of the jobs that we have, and come on, you were Miami Beach mayor. You know, it's a lot about the tourists, and so you're going to have a lot of these service jobs, not high-paying jobs.
Well, I can tell you this. One of our core competencies, no question about it, is tourism. But we have this little thing on the East Coast. I call it the Silicon Valley of Florida. It's called NASA. And it's an area that we're going to expand with private space travel. You see it with Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. We want to do what President Kennedy said years ago. What NASA can do for our state is create great business opportunities. Listen, the governor's had a vision. He has a vision of the state as you get a great job working at Walmart's or Applebee's or McDonald's. My vision is very different. I have a vision of creating great jobs with great companies and investing in education so our universities become hotbeds for startup companies. Let me tell you this. You know, I come from a little town called Boston originally. And, you know, and Boston's an interesting place. You know, Boston's a place where every great company is moving, or startups. General Electric moved their world headquarters there. And people say, well, why did they move to Boston? You know, did they offer them a great financial incentive? No, that's not what happened. The reason that people are coming to Boston and great companies and great startups, they have the best education, they have the best public transportation, and they have the culture of excellence. It's time for Florida to step up our game, and also create a 21st century economy like states like that.
Again, I'm talking with former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine. He is one of the Democratic candidates running for governor this year. Again, the primary is later in August. Let's look at the current state of things. The legislature right now debating gun laws. The session's supposed to end Friday. This is, of course, you know, really pushed to the front because of the Parkland shooting. They have already taken off the table any call for an assault on or ban on assault rifles, and they're looking at possibly arming some teachers. You've come out and said, let's talk about the ban on assault rifles. Again, if you're governor, you're looking at a legislature run by Republicans. What makes you think that you're going to move the needle on that issue?
Well, first of all, you're so sure we're looking at a legislature run by, you know, Republicans. I'm not so sure about that. What we've seen in special elections across Florida right now is a pretty strong blue tide of Democratic wins. Now, the one thing I can tell you is that I'll do everything in my power as governor to ban assault rifles. But I will know one thing I will do is I'm going to bring it to the people, the power of the people. What does that mean? I'm going to make sure that we have a referendum in Florida. And we're going to ask the people of Florida, would you like your local mayors, council people, and commissioners to decide your local gun safety regulation? I believe the people of Florida are going to say yes. And with that, we'll let Dade, Broward, we'll let the local communities decide their own gun safety policy.
That goes on. You want to overturn that 2011 law, which
100%,
says...
100%. Because I believe what Thomas Jefferson said. Government works best. It's closest to its people. Unfortunately, what's happening in Tallahassee is they kind of believe in the old Soviet-style government, where you had central planning out of Moscow. That didn't work out too well for the Soviet Union. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to bring the power and the government back to the people of Florida.
Again, the number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine running for governor on the Democratic ticket. Quite a few names in that hat. What are your questions for the gubernatorial candidate? Let's go to Randy real quickly, calling us from Wellington. Randy, thanks for joining us.
Yes, hi, thank you. I really like spring, but... And I agree that, unfortunately, I think that Mr. Gillum's a great guy, but he's not going to carry South Florida or the state. I did hear you talk about a 67-county strategy, but you've definitely got to focus on other parts of the country because Democrats, in general, unfortunately, I'm one, but they tend to be apathetic. They have short memories. And, you know, we don't have a good bench, even, to put people on. And after what happened in 2016, I think you've got a tough run.
All right. So talking about Democrat, what's your strategy for, well, you know what, Randy, thank you so much for the call. I mean, and I was going to get to this too, is okay, look, I mean, people in South Florida know you, but what's your strategy for all the other counties in the state?
Well, let me tell you this. I announced that I'm running for governor on November 1st. We're now tied in the polls to my nearest opponent. We also have name ID
Gwen Graham
to a level higher than my nearest opponent. Okay. So what we have done is we've been on television statewide with TV commercials ever since. Full saturation, and we plan on being on TV until victory in November. Number two, we're in people's homes. We've done what's called this Florida Live Living Room Tour. Matter of fact, I did one today in a Haitian American family's home in North Miami. All over the state, we go into people's living rooms. We talk to people. When I ran for mayor, I knocked on 6,000 doors. I would love to do that in Florida and knock on 20 million doors. I just don't have time. But I can tell you this. You win elections with three M's. Money, message, and messenger. We believe that we have all three. Number one, financially, we have great resources. Number two, the message that we're bringing to people of Florida is resonating. And number three, I think I'm an okay messenger.
All right, so here's the thing. Now, you talk about there are some polls, too, that do put Gwen Graham just a little bit ahead of you. The other one, though, that I thought was interesting, A survey from the University of North Florida Public Opinion Research Lab shows that one of the challenges for the candidates and many Democrats is that you're not well known statewide. What about that? I mean, is it enough to just say you're going to throw a lot of ads out there and to get your name out there? How do you become somebody, a name that just rolls off the tongue?
Sure. Well, I can tell you that we're running our campaign very differently. I always say we're the Amazon of politics. What does that mean? We go direct to the customer. We don't have filters. We go right to the actual customers. Those are the voters. And we do it by being in their living rooms. We do it by social media. We do it by being on television. And we do it by taking positions and reaching the people of Florida. I've only been in the race since November 1st, and I'm always tied with the front runner, who, as you can imagine, has big name ID because of her dad, who's a wonderful guy. I think we're in a great trajectory. But the people of Florida, and this is the purple state, understand that the way you make purple is you mix red and blue. And I said, there's no monopoly on good ideas, not Republican, not Democrat, or independent.
How does the message change, though? Like, you're in South Florida. Again, people recognize you, but then you go up to Orlando, you go up to parts of Tallahassee, Jacksonville, or any of the rural areas. So how does the message change?
Message doesn't change. What I have found, Lewis, and I've been all over the state nonstop for almost a year, is that everyone in Florida wants the same thing. They want great schools. They want excellent environmental policy. They want job opportunities. They want public transportation. People want the same thing in Florida. They just want to make sure that you're authentic, that you have a history of getting things done like I do, and then they'll vote for you.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Again, talking with former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, one of the Democrats running for governor in 2018 here in the state of Florida. Let me go to Ari in Hollywood. Ari, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd just like to know what your thoughts, your stance is on school voucher programs, such as the already existing step-up program or maybe private school vouchers.
All right. Ari, thank you so for the call and for the question. All right. School vouchers.
Well, I can tell you, I grew up in Hollywood, Florida. I went to Dania Middle School, and I went to Hollywood Hills High. So I am a big believer in public school, and I believe we're in the public school business, and I believe we should invest in our public schools. Nothing against private schools or charter schools. I just don't believe we should invest taxpayer money in someone else's business. And the way I describe that, it's kind of like the post office. We're in the post office business. Now, I'm not so sure we want to invest taxpayer money in FedEx or DHL or UPS because we're in the post office business. So I believe that we need to invest in public schools, make our public schools the best. Right now, we're 46th in the nation, which is despicable. Our teachers earn $10,000 less than other teachers nationwide. And I believe we need to make our public schools better. So that's what my focus will be.
So you're ready to go back and overturn or fight some of the old legislation from this legislature. Again, it's putting a lot of money into vouchers and into charter schools.
I'm ready to invest in our public schools. I do not believe we should invest in someone else's business.
All right, let me go back to the phones. Let's go to John in Hollywood. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You've mentioned a number of times in this conversation about companies like Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and the like. My question is regarding small businesses. Most of the economy is run more by small businesses, and I wanted to know specifically, not necessarily in platitudes, but regarding what policies are either on the books right now that you'd like to change, or what kind of policies or laws would you like to put on the books that would benefit the small business owners?
It's a great question.
John, thanks so much for the question.
And matter of fact, I know a little about small businesses because I started one myself with $500. And that small business became a large company. And I did it by hard work and sweat and by getting great people around me. And I believe that the way for us to spur greater development of companies is to invest in the modern day oil wells of today that actually produce these companies, and those are universities and colleges. And those where the hottest technology and the hottest startups can happen. We invest in education, we invest in our programs, and we will have more unique startups. Now, as far as government intervention, listen, you know, we have a program down here with the startups in South Florida that's made us one of the best. I believe that we should offer greater government programs to allow more female entrepreneurs to own companies in Florida. But I can tell you that, starting a company, you want to make sure that the playing field is equal, that everyone has an opportunity to start a company, that it's an easy access to starting a company, and that there's resources and financing available. As an entrepreneur governor, I think I'd be pretty uniquely qualified to help foster small business growth.
All right, before I take a break here real quickly, I just wanted to come back to the question of schools again, because you don't want to you want to put your focus on public schools, the public school system. Does that mean no funding at all for charters or private schools at all?
Well, I can tell you this. Obviously, whatever is in place may be challenging to overturn. But going forward, If I'm elected governor, my focus is going to be making our public schools the greatest in the nation, certainly not 46 we're at right now.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Again, we're talking to former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine. He is one of the Democrats running for governor of the state of Florida. Again, the primary is not until late August, but we're taking your calls, your questions for the mayor. What do you want to know about his race for governor? What do you expect from him, or what do you want to know about what he's going to do if he does win? Again, the number is 800-743-9576. More on this conversation in just a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio by former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, one of the Democrats running for governor in this year's election. There is a big field, and still we're expecting more names to jump in, perhaps within the coming months. I'm going to go to the phones back here in just a minute, but I wanted to, Mayor Levine, I wanted to ask you real quickly about this, again, this pro-business approach that you have. One of the other issues, too, that you fought for when you were the mayor was the living wage issue. Obviously, businesses fought you, though, and businesses continue to fight this idea of raising the minimum wage to having a living wage because they say it's going to hurt business. I may have to cut back on staff or hours. And so now you're bringing this to the state. What have you heard from people, and where do you think that fight's going to go?
I think it's going to go to the Florida Supreme Court. We passed the minimum living wage on Miami Beach because we knew it was the right thing to do. People that work and try to live on Miami Beach can't do it on $8.25 an hour. So you ask yourself a question, how do they do it? Well, if they can't do it on their own, then they're going to have government assistance through welfare programs. Why are we subsidizing the cost of people's businesses? Why can't they pay a fair wage? Listen, I've heard that economic argument before, that they'll cut staff. All studies have shown that that's not the case, that if you do the right thing and you pay your people a wage they can live on, everyone does better. And we live in a state, I call it Team Florida. If you live in Florida, you're on Team Florida, you deserve the right to have a wage that you can live on. And I know someone will say to you, oh, what about that little McDonald's owner? Oh, I feel so bad. Well, let me tell you about that little McDonald's owner. They actually, it's 180 McDonald's owned by a private equity group out of Chicago. And by the way, they love Florida because you and I as taxpayers, we subsidize their business so they can pay their people a low wage, and we as taxpayers will make it up with social services. It's not the right thing. And I can tell you, great companies coming to Florida aren't impressed that you don't pay your people a good living wage.
All right, let's go back to the phones again. Questions for Mayor Philip Levine and his run for governor. Let's start with Andre in Plantation. Andre, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is your campaign receiving financial support either directly or indirectly from the NRA or other so-called Sanctum Amendment groups?
All right, Andre, thank you for the call. Are you getting any money from the NRA?
I call the NRA not responsible for anything. And I can tell you that the last person in the world they're going to offer money to is going to be Philip Levine. I think if they give politicians a grade, I think I'd probably get an F minus or an incomplete. So answer is no. And we don't take money from them. We don't take money from Sugar. We don't take money from FP&L. We're very discerning on anyone that wants to contribute to the campaign. Because there's one thing I do know is he who pays the piper picks the tunes. And that's not going to happen in
all
this
right.
election.
As you said, it is true that, you know, we could see a shift in the legislature. But as is, again, the legislature is controlled by Republicans. We did a piece on this the other day where we looked at the influence of the NRA on this legislature, especially lobbyist Marion Hammer. And so if you're the governor and you're having to deal with this, I mean, how, again, do you press any kind of gun legislation with that sort of influence?
Well, what I'm going to do, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, if we're not able to get it done through the legislature at the time, we will take the issue to the people of Florida. It will be in a referendum form, and the people will make a decision. Do you believe your local leaders should now have the right and opportunity to set gun safety laws? And I believe the people of Florida will overwhelmingly say yes.
All right, let's go back to the phones. I want to go to Carlos in Coral Gables. Carlos, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have two questions. What will candidate Levine do on the state level to combat sea level rise and climate change? And also, what, if anything, he'll do to make Florida a sanctuary state?
All right, Carlos, thank you so much for the call. Let's tackle one here at a time. All right, I mean, it's an issue that you brought to the front as mayor, was the issue of sea level rise and climate change, really putting Miami on the global map on this problem and how the cities are trying to deal with it. But we have seen, again, allegations that this governor doesn't even want to talk about climate change. But how do you approach this on a statewide level? And I'm curious, too, is like when you travel the state, What are people up in North Florida saying, or Central Florida saying about this problem?
Well, number one, as you know, when I became mayor of Miami Beach, I campaigned on the fact I was literally kayaking down one of our roads with my boxer dog, Earl, during a sunny day where it was flooding. What I did, and I said I was going to do, is we're going to take action. We put together a $500 million program, started raising roads, raising seawalls, changing building codes, and we did it. And at 15, 20% of the city that was completed, it worked. We became a poster child for this issue. I was in a documentary with Leonardo DiCaprio, Before the Flood, with Al Gore and Truth to Power. And what we showed the world is a city can fight back successfully, and that's what we did. Number one, if I'm honored to become governor, we will have first of its kind a chief resiliency officer of the state of Florida. We will have regional resiliency officers around the state. What I have learned is that one size does not fit all. What works in Miami Beach may be different in Tampa and different in Jacksonville. But the one thing I'll tell you, because you brought up Jacksonville, is Jacksonville, during the hurricane, the river flooded. It incapacitated the entire downtown area to the point where these office buildings were non-functional. This once-in-a-century storm phenomena is not once in a century. It's once or twice a year. We must have a state that's resilient. We need to invest. We need to bring the expertise. And that's something that I would absolutely 100% make sure
and,
that we
and
do.
Jacksonville is on the St. John's River is what you're talking about. The other question that Carlos had brought up was the issue of sanctuary cities, sanctuary communities. Look, this is a federal issue, but we've heard the back and forth that basically, you know, the Homeland Security is saying, look, you know, we need support from law enforcement in these communities, and cities are pushing back. But, I mean, your take on how the state of Florida should handle this question.
Well, it's a shame that everyone, for political purposes, brings up this, quote, sanctuary cities, when the fact of the matter is we don't have sanctuary cities in the state of Florida. This is a made-up myth. And the fact is that it's brought up by politicians to create division and hatred in our community. That, I believe, is wrong. It's like talking about what's our policy towards Pluto, okay? We don't have sanctuary cities. Do I believe we should have sanctuary cities? Absolutely not. Do I believe that we should enforce immigration laws? Absolutely yes. But in the same token, we are a tolerant society. The American dream that has made us successful is about immigration, but it must be a controlled immigration with a firm policy that makes sense. And with that said, we know we need to make sure that the DACA, the young people, the dreamers have the opportunity to stay in our country. It's cruel not to allow that. We got to make sure it happens. And also the 11 million undocumented folks that are in our country, we need to make sure if they do not have criminal background records, they must have a pathway to citizenship.
I want to get one more call in before we run out of time. I want to go to Tara, I believe it is, in Pembroke Pines. Tara, I hope I'm saying that right.
Yes, you are. It's Tara.
Go ahead, Tara.
I have a couple of questions. You know, the service industry is such a huge portion of our economy, but what I'd like to know is, what can a governor do in terms of protection for service industry workers? Oftentimes, there isn't a stable or even existent HR representative, and a lot of these restaurants, bars, and all of this nightlife that makes up so much of the economy. And oftentimes, immigrants as well as young college student workers are being taken advantage of in their workplace. My other question has to do with funding and plan for the treatment of the opioid crisis in the state. What do you plan to do as governor in order to treat the public and not have private institutions completely take over and price out people looking for treatment?
All right, Tara, two questions. Thank you so much for that. All right, real quickly, we'll go through these. This goes back to the question about service workers. We depend so much on service workers and that kind of work, but I believe what Tara was asking is about protection for these folks. This may go back to what you were saying on living wage.
Well, 100%. We need to make sure that they're earning a living wage so that they can live in the state of Florida. They need affordable housing. We need to work with the private sector to come up with the right incentives they can also live. But you'd have a governor that actually grew up in the service industry. That's how I grew up. I park cars at hotels. I wash dishes at restaurants. I get it. I understand. And you have to have someone there who realizes how important the backbone is of these people. One of the first things I'll do as governor is pass an executive order for equal pay for equal work, to make sure everyone is treated equally in the state of Florida going forward.
And how much of it is going to have to come from Tallahassee, but how much of it should be local? This was your fight when you were the mayor.
I believe in local law. I believe that we need to set a higher minimum living wage in the state of Florida and then allow the local communities to set their wage above that if they choose to do so. Because remember something, it costs a little different to buy a hamburger in Miami Beach than it does in Pensacola. And I think we need to respect that and understand that going forward.
The other thing that she brought up was the issue of opioids. Of course, South Florida at the center of this problem in the state of Florida and in the country, really one of the worst places. But, I mean, what more can the state do? Governor Scott has tried to tackle this.
We have to invest. We have to invest in Team Florida, whether it's mental health issues or opioid crisis. And the other thing that I know we need to do in the state of Florida is we need to join the litigation against these drug manufacturers who have pushed these pills onto our community, and we're suffering the effects of it. Let's make sure that our state's compensated the same as tobacco.
In 30 seconds or so, tell the voters again who you are, why you're running for governor.
I'm running for governor because I believe in the American dream, which is the Florida dream. I'm not right, I'm not left, I'm forward. I'm pro-people, I'm pro-business. I believe that we want a state where our kids don't leave our state for great jobs, that we invest in our state, invest in education, invest in healthcare, our environment, to attract the great companies of our country to come to Florida, open up in Florida, and let's make sure Florida is an innovation startup state.
Again, he is former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine, one of the Democrats running for governor in this year's election. Mayor Levine, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. You can continue. Again, we had a lot of calls that came in, but you can always post your questions online. You can find us at Facebook, WLRN Sundial, and we will see if we can find those answers for you. Coming up, we want to take a look at why we pay so much attention to something like the Parkland shooting, but we ignore the story of children and gun violence in other neighborhoods. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, there are a lot of conversations happening now across the state and the nation about gun violence and youth in the wake of the Parkland shooting. But in some South Florida communities, those conversations have already been happening for a while. In neighborhoods hard hit by everyday gun violence, children in Liberty City have taken to the streets in the past to protest for the right to play outside safely.
We don't want to die. Stop the shooting. 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 We don't want to die.
Well, recently there was a meeting held at the Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church in Liberty City to address the shootings in Miami-Dade. At one point, Miami-Dade Commission Chairman Steve Bova was talking about banning assault rifles, but Tangela Sear, an anti-gun violence activist who planned the meeting, chimed in.
That asked for the banning of assault weapons, and furthermore asked for more background checks and whatnot.
That don't touch our community. You can ban every rifle you want to ban. These kids wasn't even killed by rifles. Someone was killed by 45.
Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert said that there have to be harsher penalties for those who help people who shouldn't have guns get them.
Whether it's a girlfriend buying one gun for her boyfriend, or it's a guy buying 20 AK-47s and then reporting them stolen, we need to find a way to make straw buyers go to prison. Make them actually criminally liable for the guns that they buy and that they say they lost. Because if you buy a gun, you should be obligated to actually maintain it safely.
Well, joining us now is WLRN reporter Nadege Green. She was at that meeting and others and has been covering the story for years now. Nadege, a pleasure to have you.
Hey.
All right, so let's start with this. Take us to that meeting in Liberty City. Who was there? What was going on?
So this is actually the second meeting. This is part of a coalition with Tangela Sears, Luther Campbell, also known as Uncle Luke, and other community members who have come together who say, as a community, we want to get together and talk about what are some of the solutions to address the everyday gun violence that's impacting our communities. And so this was the second meeting, and there was a lot of institutions were there. You had Superintendent Carvalho, you had Miami Gardens Mayor, who you just heard, Oliver Gilbert, City of Miami Mayor was there, Francis Suarez. You had representatives from the State Attorney's Office, the U.S. Attorney's Office. Several law enforcement agencies were also in the building, because collectively this is a community issue that spans from South Miami-Dade County Miami-Dade County to the northern border of Miami Gardens.
And this was after the Parkland shooting.
Right, but this meeting was planned before Parkland. So they had one meeting prior, and so this was a follow-up meeting to that first meeting.
I was curious as to what, because look, the Parkland shooting is this mass shooting, so it's going to get national attention. But we heard from some of the cuts. I mean, the conversation on the assault on or the ban on assault rifles is become center stage. But I mean, what are the folks in this community and at this meeting specifically, What are they saying about all the attention that's being brought on because of Parkland? Not necessarily what's happening in their neighborhood, but because of Parkland.
I think in the meeting, everyone was like, what happened in Parkland was a tragedy. And those kids there have every right to be horrified and to move as they have done to bring attention to what happened there. But you also heard in the meeting that we also need to focus on what's happening here, right? We need to focus that every day we have children who are being killed in the state of Florida, that the issue of gun violence spans the gamut from mass shootings to everyday shootings. The Tampa Bay Times did a brilliant series that looked at children gun deaths in the state of Florida. And at that time, it was every 17 hours a child is shot in this state. So every 2 weeks, we lose almost like the amount of kids you lost in Parkland in the state of Florida, from unintentional shootings, from young people who get their hands on guns, to violent crime. And so that's what we're hearing out in the community, is that we need to start talking about, and we need to continue this conversation about gun violence and how it impacts everyday lives, and not just focus on one thing. We can do many things at once.
One of the things that jumped out in listening to this, and this is a part of a story that that you've been working on that's going to come out soon, and it was that back and forth, you know, when Tangela Sears had spoken up about, people are talking about assault rifles, and that's, you know, that tends to be the weapon used in mass shootings. And then she jumped in and said, wait a second, it's, you know, a lot of these kids are not dying because of assault rifles, not in our neighborhood.
Right. I think one of the biggest issues that one of the biggest takeaways I've seen at many of these meetings is people are asking hard questions to institutions, saying, okay, tell us, how is this impacting us? Where are the guns coming from? That's one of the main questions. Where are the guns coming from? And then you get crickets, nothing. No one has the answer to that. And part of the reason why there's no answer to that is, number one, you have to catch who did it, right? Many of these shootings remain unsolved. So up until the point you actually have the shooter in hand with whatever weapon that they use, you can't trace it. But even if you had the shooter in hand, the last time there was a federal study or a study that looked at where felons of violent crimes got their guns from was in the 1980s. We are now in 2018, and that's nationally, right? So we know that the federal government does not fund gun research. And on a local level, we don't do any kind of gun research. And so it's really hard to quantify or have data or information. We are operating from a point of not knowing. We just don't know.
And one of the things, though, is, too, that they brought up is that some of these people, or a lot of these people who are, you know, the perpetrators in these shootings, they're not buying their guns legally. They're not going to gun shows.
Right. So we have a lot of anecdotes on like where guns potentially come from in the community. Again, because we don't study this, because we don't have any data around this. You don't have any hard information. But some of the anecdotes we heard were, you know, straw buyers, a girlfriend or a family member who buys the gun knowing that they're buying it legally. They're buying it legally, but they plan on handing it off to someone who shouldn't have it. Maybe someone who isn't allowed to have a gun, and they'll pass it on, or it ends up in the black market where they can get a lot more money for it. There were stolen guns. Stolen guns is huge. The Trace recently did an investigation. The Trace is a nonprofit news organization that focuses solely on gun violence, that looked at hundreds of thousands of guns that get stolen in the U.S. And then linked them directly back to violent crimes that you would see in neighborhoods.
Again, I'm talking with WLRN reporter Nadege Green. We're talking about this meeting that was held recently at Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church in Liberty City. And again, not the first meeting, but just a recent meeting where leaders from the community meeting with folks from the community talking about gun violence. And yes, a lot of attention has been put on, you know, the Parkland shooting and the mass shooting. Any mass shooting is going to get a lot of media attention on a national level. But folks here are talking about the fact that there is gun violence impacting children's lives, people's lives, every day. And where's the attention on that? And what is the answer? How do we deal with this? Because assault rifles may not necessarily be the problem. It just is the issue of where these guns are coming from, as Nadege has told us, and what can cities do about it? We want to hear from you, by the way, if you have a story to share, if there's a concern you have. Maybe you were at the meeting. What did you hear from leaders? Are you satisfied with what they're trying to do, or is there more that you're looking for? Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can find us online, by the way, on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Nadege, remind us, who is Tangela Sears? I'm saying that right?
Sears. Yes, Tangela Sears. Okay. We go way back to my intern days at the Miami Herald. She is a constant presence in Miami-Dade County, specifically in Black Miami. After shootings, she has always been an anti-gun violence activist. She is a go-to person when it comes to parents trying to figure out how the system works and dealing with police. She is the person that, you know, she often describes it as getting the phone call and all you hear is a mother wailing and you know their baby got shot. More recently, she has codified like her work in the community with parents of murdered kids of Miami-Dade County. And she herself now sadly belongs to that club because her son was killed a few years ago in Tallahassee.
Again, we talked about how many, you mentioned how many kids are dying every year in Florida by gun violence. But in Miami-Dade County, I mean, this last year, 2017, it did go down, but it's still, it was more than a dozen, right?
We didn't pull the exact numbers from last year, but we know from through Jackson Memorial Hospital, for example, we had data over the past 10 years. They saw more than 700 teens and children admitted for gunshot injuries. Most of them survived. We don't even study survivors, right? We don't even look at what does it mean to survive this. I think what typically grabs headlines or what we notice are when people die. We know the names of the children who died in our communities, Tequila Forshee, King Carter. We know the ones who die, but we also know there are hundreds of kids who survived and are now probably into adulthood or approaching it. And what does that mean to have lived through this trauma? Again, this is an invisible population. They carry visible and invisible scars, but we are not paying any attention on what that means within our communities, long-term or short-term for that matter.
Something that was mentioned, and we did play part of the clip, but something that was mentioned too at the meeting is what can local governments do about gun legislation? And well, look, there's obviously there's the state law that takes that power away from the local. So what are the folks in the community saying about what they expect from the mayors compared to what they hope maybe Tallahassee is going to do?
You heard a lot about law enforcement, a lot of push to have resources in law enforcement to actually solve these shootings. Again, if a shooting is unsolved, you can't answer most of the questions we're talking about right now. We don't know who did it. We don't know how they did it. And we surely don't know what gun they used to do it because the shootings are unsolved. And so there's a lot of frustration in the community about that. You have all of these parents, all these family members who are waiting for justice that just has not come yet. And so there was a lot of talk about pouring more resources into the police department so that these shootings can be solved, for the state attorney's office to work even closer with the police departments, with the community in order to solve these shootings. And also there were calls to bring in the federal government even to help solve a lot of the homicides or shootings that you're seeing in Miami-Dade County.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Again, if you were at that meeting, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what happened. Maybe you've had the chance to talk to your community leaders, your elected officials. You know, what are you saying to them? What are they responding back to you? You know, how has gun violence impacted your life? Again, share your story with us, 800-743-9576, or go online, find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and continue this conversation here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, you know, talking about a special meeting that was held recently in Liberty City, talking about gun violence. And yeah, a lot of the attention has been on Parkland, the Parkland shooting, the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, a terrible tragedy as it was. And mass shootings like that do get a lot of attention. But as we've been hearing, you know, a lot of kids under anybody under 18 here in South Florida have been victims to gun violence and not as much attention on them. What is the problem? What have we missed here? What do we need to do as a community to reduce these, to get rid of this altogether, to end the gun violence and to make streets safer for all children? Again, the number is 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. I will go to the phones here in just a moment, but I'm joined by WLRN reporter Nadege Green, who covered that story, who covered the meeting. And we're going to hear her story, by the way, on WLRN tomorrow. So that's going to air in Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I want to go back to this meeting. And, you know, in conversations I've had with you over the last few years, you know, you have your politicians who come out and they talk about the problem and everything else, but the community's always pushing back because they feel like there's a lot of talk, not a lot of action.
I mean, it's almost identical to actually what you hear after mass shootings, right? Where people get upset. They're like, politicians show up and they say, not one more after Columbine, not one more after Sandy Hook, not one more after this one, and then another one and another one. Well, the same thing happens on a neighborhood level, right? We said, and Mayor Gilbert pointed this out at the meeting, we said not one more after Marlon Eason. We said not one more after King Carter. We said not one more after Tequila Forshee. These are all children under the age of 13 who were killed here in Miami-Dade County. And so we're really good at saying not one more, but what about the part that comes after that? Once you've made these declarations, what actions actually happen to prevent the shootings? And that is the part where we're at in the community. This week, there's going to be another meeting, I believe this Thursday, organized by young Black folks in the Overtown community. I can't even say the name of the meeting because it has a bleep word in it, but it's like we're bleeping tired of this. And so there's a meeting happening around younger folks having these conversations. And these are not new conversations. In the community, you have folks who have been working towards ending gun violence. You have folks who have been pushing towards this. But I think the next step has been like, what policies can be enacted? What role is government playing in this? What role are police departments playing in this? And how do you bring everyone together to address these very real issues? Again, when we talk about where the guns are coming from, that's not an answer that was really answered at the meeting. And it's not one that I've heard answered yet. It was once, okay, there is an arrest made. Who is tracking where the guns are coming from? Who is quantifying what the trends are in order for you to say like, well, now that we know, here's what we can do. Absent of data, we are often left with just stories, and those stories often don't lead to policy change.
And Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert talking about, in the clip earlier, that maybe we need to go after the folks who are getting the guns for these for the perpetrators. It could be the girlfriend, it could be a relative, it could be somebody else,
or it could be a stolen gun.
That too. I mean, how do they approach this problem? Or what have they said how they're going to approach this problem? Has anybody come up with any kind of solution on that?
I don't think there's been a solution on where the guns come from part of it. I think that is like one of the things that's in the works right now. And when we're talking about like what is the next steps from a community level, it's really how do you track where guns come from, and how do you hold folks accountable, and who is going to be doing that work intentionally?
You told me, by the way, just real quickly, that some of the students from Stoneman Douglas now are they're stretching out beyond the mass shooting issue, the assault rifles.
Right, this past weekend, they met with the Parkland survivors, met with survivors of gun violence in Chicago, teen survivors of everyday gun violence, like the ones we're talking about in places like Overtown, Liberty City, West Perrine, Ghouls. And Emma Gonzalez, who was one of the survivors of Parkland, she tweeted out that, you know, the issue of gun violence, while, you know, the nation is paying attention to what happened in Parkland, it happens every day in communities like Chicago and communities like Miami-Dade and parts of Lauderhill, Fort Lauderdale even, and that we also should be uplifting these voices and be talking about that. And so you are seeing the students from Parkland talking about that because it's been going on. And so they're saying that they will use their platforms to also address everyday gun violence. And she was like, we stand with minority communities, LGBTQ community, anyone who is impacted by gun violence, that the Never Again movement is not solely in Parkland.
All right, let me go to the phones real quickly, get a couple of calls in. I'm going to start with Steve in Fort Lauderdale. Steve, thanks for your patience. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys, you know, and everything that you guys are doing. And Nadaj, you always have awesome stories, so I just want to let you know right off the bat.
Thank you.
I have a question. Because when I saw the shooting at Stoneman Douglas, they had counselors and everyone available to the teachers, to the students, to everyone. And in the everyday community, like you said, in Liberty City, Overtown, where the shootings are done more on a stretched out basis, that's not available, it's not done the same way. So my question is, has anyone done any kind of study as far as, and I know PTSD is normally reserved for military or for people who've been to war, or even first responders, but what about the effects of the gun violence mentally on the children that grew up in that neighborhood?
Absolutely.
Has anyone done anything on that?
So locally, no. We don't have any studies locally that looks at the mental health impact of gun violence on Miami-Dade County children who live this. We, WLRN, did a series, Young Survivors, The Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence. It was a year-long series last year where we started to look at that from a journalistic perspective. And we do know from studies that have been done elsewhere in comparable places, like in Chicago and other places, that the long-term impact, there is long-term impact, mental health impact from PTSD to anxiety to depression. I will say, having covered gun violence here in Miami-Dade and talked to moms and family members and siblings who describe, you know, having anxiety, depression. There are some of the moms of parents of murdered kids who have gone to psychologists, who have gone to therapists, in some cases, who have been medicated in order to deal with having, you know, outlived their child and that. So we do know that there is, yes, a huge need for mental health support in some of these communities. But no, you're absolutely correct. You don't see, no one is setting up a free mental health clinic in the heart of the communities at the after some of these shootings. No.
Steve, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate the comments and the question. Yeah, you know what, because we talked about after the Stoneman Douglas shooting, they're providing that mental health service to the students and the families. I'm just curious what schools in Miami-Dade, but any of the districts, if you know, what do they offer on a regular basis when it comes to counseling?
Specifically in Miami-Dade, when after a shooting, like let's say a student is shot in Miami-Dade, shot and survived, shot and killed, it really depends on whether or not the principal puts in the request to the district. The district will send out a counselor to the school, and the counselor may be there from anywhere from up to a day, 3 days or so, but it's not long term, right? It's more short term. But when we talk about like mental health, I interviewed LaKayla Rollins, who four of her friends were killed her senior year of high school. She was a senior at Miami Northwestern High School. And she talked to me about the impact of that over time. And it wasn't until she got to college that she realized, I really should have seen someone, because the way I was dealing with this and the way I'm still dealing with it, it hurts. That was a lot to bear. You know, she talked about pretty much carrying the ghost of her dead friends across the stage with her. That was a lot for a 17-year-old. And so it's not until sometimes a year later, many of the moms or even siblings that I've interviewed who have lost kids to gun violence, they will tell you that it's not until like a year later, it really hits you. 2 years later, 5 years later, it does not go away. And I mean, if you have health insurance, sure, you can go see a therapist, you can see a counselor. But that immediate, like, we recognize that there's trauma here response. We don't typically see that on a community level for issues of gun violence. And I mean, just in general, we do a poor job with mental health.
All right. Let me take one more call here before we finish up. Tony in Tamarack. Tony, thank you for your patience.
Oh, yeah. Hi. How you doing? Very nice show, and it's thoughtful. And I just have a couple of observations.
Real quick, one, if you could, for that, me.
Yeah, sure. One is that, why is it gun violence? It's actually, we have a culture of violence that we need to deal with. And the other is, which was slightly touched on, why do we keep running to extreme solutions? One side knows that arming the teachers is a non-starter. Other side knows an assault weapon ban, whatever that is a non-starter. We run to that, and it seems we get nothing done in the middle. You know, let's really try and calm down and look at some solutions that we can implement generally and gradually throughout our society. Have a good one.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate the call. Violent society in general. Look, I mean,
but we say gun violence because we're talking about guns,
right? In these meetings, does that ever, you know, does it ever go beyond the gun problem, or is it, I mean, beyond that too?
No, these meetings are specifically about gun deaths and shootings. This is about the impact that guns are having on a community level, and so that's why we're talking about guns.
All right, and you said there's another meeting that's coming up at some.
Yes, I believe there's one this Thursday planned, a separate group, not the same group at Mount Calvary, but young folks who are going to be talking again, the impact of gun violence in the community.
And again, your story, again, focused on this particular meeting at this church. It airs tomorrow on WLRN. So again, it'll be up online soon that you could check it out. This was a meeting that was held at Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church in Liberty City shortly after the Parkland shootings. And again, just bringing to light this problem of gun violence in our communities, that it goes beyond just a mass shooting. And there's more than just a debate about assault rifles, but there's a lot more going on. WLRN reporter Nadezh Green joining us in studio. Nadezh, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
And that is the program for today. Really appreciate you tuning in and listening. Remember, you can always go online, find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. And let us know what you think about anything in today's show. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.